Welcome to the Final Draft Great Conversations podcast. Today's great conversation is with Christos Tsolkas. Christos is an author, playwright, and essayist. His novels include Loaded, Barracuda, and The Slap, for which he received Booker and Miles Franklin listings. Today, Christos is joining me to discuss his latest novel, Damascus. I'm Andrew Popel, and every week I broadcast Final Draft from the studios of 2SER in Sydney. We record on Gadigal land of the Eora Nation, and I want to acknowledge the traditional custodians and their ongoing connection to the land. Their stories are the original stories, and this land was never ceded. I pay my respects to them. Final Draft explores the best of Australia's books, writing, and literary culture, as featured on 2SER. Now, the Great Conversations podcast is your chance to hear more of these discussions. Damascus tells the story of Saul of Tarsus. Saul was a Greek-speaking Jew, a tent maker who some 2,000 years ago was met on the road to Damascus by a blinding light and was convinced that he must bring the teachings of the Jewish prophet Jesus to the world. This is a story perhaps well known to many, while others may not have encountered the tent maker whose letters came to spread Christianity to the world. In Damascus, Christos Tsolkas takes the story of Saul the man and explores his life and the origins of the early church. Join me as we discover Christos Tsolkas' Damascus. Now, my name's Andrew Popel, and it is with great pleasure that I welcome Christos Tsolkas to the studio. Christos is an author, a playwright, an essayist. His novels include Loaded, Barracuda, and The Slap, for which he received Booker and Miles Franklin listings. And today, Christos is joining me to discuss his latest novel, Damascus. Welcome, Christos.
Thank you so much, Andrew. It's a real pleasure.
It is a pleasure, and I can't wait to get into this book, because Damascus tells the story of Saul of Tarsus. Saul was a Greek-speaking Jew, a tent maker, who some 2,000 years ago was met on the road to Damascus by a blinding light and was convinced that he must bring the teachings of the Jewish prophet Jesus to the world. This is a story that's perhaps well known to many, while others may not have encountered this tent maker whose letters came to spread Christianity around the world. And that's where I kind of want to start, because I know this is a narrative, it's a worldview that you were raised in, Christos, as was I. But I've also had it highlighted recently that this is not a story everyone knows or understands. So religion, I see through pop culture, phenomenon like The Good Place, Fleabag, Derry Girls, even Kanye West's new album, that there's this enormous popular consciousness and discussion about the Christian religion. The Bible in Australia, a historical work recently won at the Prime Minister's Literary Awards. And then, of course, there is the ongoing discussion of the Catholic Church and their attempts to reckon with an ongoing history of abuse. What do you make of this broader discussion? And does Damascus in any way intersect with the conversation?
I think it's inevitable that the novel does intersect with that conversation, simply because I was writing it under the shadow of everything that you've just described and talked about. But it is also a particular grappling with, an attempt by myself to come to terms with this, with Saul, that was his Jewish name, Paul is his, Bavlos was his Greek name, to come to terms with a series of ideas and ethics that I was raised with as an Orthodox Christian. And I think it's important to kind of frame it in the beginning in that sense, because Orthodoxy is the Eastern Church, and so it has a slight variations to what was happening in Catholicism, and certainly what happened with Protestantism, you know, a long time after the death of this prophet called Jesus. My first encounter with Paul was when I moved in high schools, moved from a very inner city migrant school to a very Anglo outer suburban school, and I fell in with some evangelical Christians who were good people. But what happened was I encountered Paul, and I encountered him through Corinthians 1, where he says, if your, you know, homosexuality is bars you from the kingdom of heaven, or more important as a young 13-year-old to be told that it bars you from God's love. And I couldn't read Paul. I couldn't read beyond that line. And then years later, I went into a church at a point of real despair, I think is the right word, in my life, and confusion. We all want paths, right? And that leads that road to Damascus moment. And I found myself falling into prayer and reading the New Testament there in the church, sobbing, but also finding this incredible relief in the ritual of prayer. And I think that's the Eastern part of my experience of Christianity, that the ritual actually gives you something. But also, this time in these words, I actually found real solace. So that happened a long time ago, Andrew, but I think the germ of this book goes back to that encounter that I had, or those two encounters with Paul, right? And trying to work out what does Paul mean and what does Christianity mean for me? I'm not a Christian, you know. I don't. And one of the real struggles with writing this book was that the first two drafts were really, they were going nowhere, because I thought I had to be faithful to the mythology around Christianity, which includes, you know, that the physical resurrected body of Jesus met Paul on the road to Damascus. Mm. It was only with the third draft I realized I'm doing something else. I'm trying to understand what these ideas meant and how they could shake the world. Yeah. And they have shaken the world. And they've shaken me. Oh, there's so much to say, so forgive me for just kind of going on for a bit.
Not at all.
A lot of people, when I said, you know, because I've been working for 5 years on this novel, I've said, when they have asked me what I'm working on, they said, oh, and I've explained I'm doing a story about Paul, St. Paul. They look at me quizzically and go, that's so different to your other novels. I don't actually think it is so different, really, because I think the question of faith has been has preoccupied me for a long time. I mean, my second book was called Jesus Man. And if I had a road to Damascus moment, it was in my early 20s when I... Because what happened is, after I gave up faith in a God, I took up a faith in something called small C communism, socialism. And I then, in my early 20s, was in Eastern Europe straight after the fall of communism and engaging seriously with people who had experienced life under communist regimes, particularly in what was then Czechoslovakia, but also what was then the former Yugoslavia. I found I had to do another reckoning with faith, and that the ideas that I had committed to had also led to massive tragedies and massive suffering for so many people. But I don't believe that nullifies the ideas. So the Damascus, the novel, is an attempt to work out what is it in the Christian ethics that shouldn't be nullified, that are really important and really speak to the world today.
I think you've touched on this, but I want to go into it a little bit more, because I didn't see this as such a huge departure. Topic-wise, yes, from novels like The Slap and Barracuda, but content and message, I saw what things that you were trying to do. And look, I learned a while back that your writing evokes an emotional response in me. So I don't flinch from that. I can't approach your work with any sort of cool rationality. And as I read, I was grateful for the scholarship that you've put into this book, but I also found it raised questions for me of the religious teachings that I'd learned as a child, of church that I no longer follow. I started to think of all the others who would pick up Damascus with their various histories. And if this isn't an incongruous question, for a reader approaching Damascus, do you see it as a religious or a secular story?
Oh, that's, you know, that question makes me realise I didn't really answer your first question about why are these stories, these myths, still current.
They may be questions that are answered in the reading for people.
Yeah, I mean that's what you hope. I do. I mean, this novel is set 2,000 years ago, but I hope that it's like a call and response, you know, in that the gospel tradition, that you can't help but think about what is happening in the contemporary world as you're reading it, and that's what. So, in terms of your that first question, I just think it's because something like the words uttered 2,000 years by whoever this prophet Jesus was, that you will love the stranger as much as you love your blood relation, that's still a radical thought, and it still has incredible implications for how we live in the world now. Think about what Australia is doing to the stranger or the refugee. But, you know, it's not only an Australian question, and I think that's why these ideas these questions are still being asked, where people are still being challenged by it. In terms of the second part, one of the greatest experiences of the last 5 years is that I've become a student for the first time in my life, right? And my partner Wayne reminded me of this the other night, because talking to writers, that anxiety that comes when you put something that has belonged to you for this a number of years and you put it out in the world. You know, it's a strange place to be. And Wayne said, don't forget what you've learned through writing Damascus. And what I learned, I mean, I did a year of research before I even put pen to paper. And I learned that there were so many different currents to early Christianity. I learned that there were so many aspects of Judaic religion that I didn't know enough and know about, and how much they influenced what we know now as Christianity. I learned about so much suffering in the ancient world that you don't read when you read the great classics of Greek and Roman philosophy or politics, because they didn't give a fuck. Can I swear?
Yeah,
they didn't give a fuck about the slave. And that's why I think all those that study was incredibly transformative. I think it's transformative, Andrew. I feel like for the first time in my life, I've been a real student. I used to be a student in my 20s at university, but I wasn't a good student. I was good at the extracurricular stuff, but I wasn't a real student. I feel like I have become, I've begun to be a student of a certain, of ideas in the world, and that's been, and Wayne's right, I think I want to carry with that in me, regardless of what happens.
And I think that's what I connected in the writing. As I read, I didn't know much about your research process actually until after I'd finished, but I saw you discussing issues and I saw you telling me about teachings that I'd learnt as a child, and I realized the universality of it. And then I started to engage with these kind of cliches that we have of history repeating, and if we don't learn, we're doomed to repeat. You know, we talk about the modern Australian history that is playing out, and will we give a fuck about the people that are currently being treated such by our government? And I wondered, are you directly engaging with this, or can we not fail but to engage when we discuss these ideas because they remain true?
Of course they do, and I think that's. I mean, you know, I had to write this book in this way, because this is the faith tradition I grew up with, right? This is the one I know. But I think all the great philosophies and I think all the great religions deal with some really basic truths to do with, you know, suffering is integral to Christianity. Mm. It's also integral to Buddhism, right? Two very, very different expressions of the idea of God, right? But the notion of suffering is central. One of the things that you discover in the research, and you actually discover going right back to those ancient texts and reading them, is the crucifixion, even for someone like yourself growing up in the Catholic faith, it loses its potency because it just becomes a symbol. There's Jesus on the cross. You really have to think through what that means. Now, to be crucified in the Roman world was the most vile of tortures, right? And that with the runaway slave, the rebel, the most dissident, abject person in the Roman world was the one who was crucified, nailed onto those crosses. And it was shameful. To have a family member who had died in that way was to live in an unbearable shame, to become yourself, because that was the nature of the ancient world, the nature of kinship, to become an outsider in the society as well. So in terms of going, what it's made me do now, walking through the contemporary world, kind of understanding that about the crucifixion, is that if you're listening to this and you happen to be Christian or have come from that tradition, right, you know, even if you've left it behind, if you cannot see that every time you step over walk past a homeless person outside Central Station, for example, right? Every time you see the face of a prison, someone who's going to prison on the nightly news, every time you see someone you hate on Twitter, that if you can't find Jesus in them, you're actually corrupting what is really fundamental in Christian ethics. And that's a really hard moral position to take. And that's what makes it, I think, incredibly revolutionary as well. Mm. So that those elements of living in the contemporary world, yes, I was thinking about when I was writing Damascus. The other one, Andrews, is I start the book with a stoning, which was also a vile punishment in the ancient world. And that was the first moral lesson I remember as a young child learning about the story of Jesus. And for those of you who don't come from that tradition, there's a moment in the Gospels where Jesus comes across a woman who's about to be stoned for adultery. And he says to the crowd of men who are about to stone her, if you are without sin, if you are blameless, then hurl the first stone, right? The moral lesson there being none of us are blameless. And the other, I think, equivalent and equally powerful message is to think about what it is to be in that woman's place, right? And the reason this is so early on that I first heard this story and was awed by the story and its meaning is, I think I was only 9 or 10, right? So I didn't know that I was going to be homosexual. But I think I had this presentiment that I could be in the middle of that crowd about to raise the stone and hurl them, right? I think I really believe that now. And this book has gone through so many drafts, but that first stone story, that stoning story has always, I just knew I wanted it to be at the beginning of the book. Because as I said, that was my first moral lesson. And I know so much I want to say about the book, so forgive me for rambling.
Not at all.
To your question about how does this book reflect the contemporary world? Because I feel like the contemporary world as I was writing this book, and for a year I disappeared from the contemporary world. I didn't read about it. I just wanted to concentrate on this period of history and theology and philosophy. It just feels like everyone is bloody hurling that first stone. It feels like none of us are taking the time to actually think what it is to walk in another's shoes.
We live in a world that has chosen to, I guess, engage with so much of what you talk about in Damascus through cliche. The idea of, throw the first stone is something that has dropped to cliche. Yes. That's how we understand it. But let's keep going into that, because Damascus, it plays out across several books. It relates Saul's direct experiences, those also of his converts and also one of his jailers. And I noted an ongoing discussion around ideas of performance, passing and masculinity. There in Saul's torment at his earthly desires throughout his life in Vrasus, if I pronounce that correctly. Yeah. In Vrasus's,
I made the name up, so you can.
You tell me then. In Vrasus's craving of a son, and in Timothy's conversion and his mutilation as he's circumcised, he wants so desperately to be converted to Judaism. These were obviously social realities within a strictly hierarchical social order, but I also found my mind constantly wandering to the contemporary conversations that we have around gender, sexuality, and self. And these are conversations that rage through classrooms and parliament, like throughout our society. I never once got any of this reading the Bible. What did the biographies of these men, either the men that you researched, or in Vrasus's case, the person you had to create as a realistic depiction of someone who might have existed, what did they teach you?
So I think there was a really important moment in the writing of this book, and it happened with a third draft where I went, Chalkis, you're not a philosopher, you're not a theologian, and you're not a historian. You're someone who loves these things, but they are very specific disciplines. And what I've chosen to do with my life, and I feel very fortunate I can do that, is be a writer. So I had to I really then began to think about all this stuff I had read, and then do the imaginative leap, which is to what would the world be like? I was very lucky. I'd gone for a few months, travelled through Anatolia, the Eastern Mediterranean. I just wanted the smells. I just wanted the landscape. I wanted that to be in my mind, you know, as I was writing this. So it became what I did was I took. So there's a we've Sol / Paul. I thought I am going to write. It's almost like going back to that 13-year-old boy, right? I'm going to write a character who is going through his own sense of shame and crisis about seeing himself as outcast in the eyes of this God that he really believes in a way that you and I could never have believed because it was so fundamental in the ancient world. And so I begin with Sol in a really in a state of crisis, and that was my way of finding it in. Finding his story, you know, and really then asking what was it in these early teachings of this prophet that could have given him solace in his life, if you like. That's Sol's story. And the moment of solace is just a moment. You cannot have faith without doubt. And one thing I've realized is that doubt is okay, actually. Even I think we get fearful about doubt. But doubt is, I mean, to really understand complexity and another human being, you've got to allow yourself to go, am I wrong? That's what doubt is, right? And then in the canonical Bible, there's a mention of a woman called Lydia, who is the first Greek, i.e. non-Jewish person, who becomes a member of Paul's way or sect. That's all we really know about Lydia, except that she too comes from a family of tent makers, which was Paul's occupation. And I knew that I wanted a woman's voice in this book because one of the things I've always known about the church is that its history of patriarchy has been really poisonous. You know, to use a really, again, an example from my youth, like my mum is the most devout member of the family, but you know when it came
also
to, but when it came to taking communion, if she was menstruating, she couldn't she couldn't go. It was just insulting, really, when you. And so I wanted to know, but what I also discovered in the research was indeed that the women were part of the early church, and so the question with Lydia that I wanted to ask is what would make a woman like her leave behind her family. Her sons, that's a really, you know, that's a potent and agonizing thing to do at this moment in history, let alone 2,000 years ago. So I created Lydia. Vrasus, who is Paul's Roman guard while he's under house arrest in Rome, is a character I created, but he came out of, I'm sorry to be long-winded, but just to understand, I really early on, so this is in the process of structuring the book, I had blood. As one of the things I really wanted to deal with, because blood was so, so part of sacrifice and so part of ritual in ancient religions. But also the thing that is another really revolutionary aspect of early Christianity is the idea that blood doesn't matter, that actually you owe more allegiance to your fellow person in your fellowship than you do to your mother or your father, for example. Amazingly radical idea, you know, even time, now. Yeah. Well, even now, really. So I wanted to have a character who hears Paul's words and is absolutely disgusted by them. That's Vrasus, because he lives a Roman and pagan code of honour. And so for him, early Christians are mad. They're deranged. He can't understand it. But the other thing that I wanted to do with Vrasus, and it comes into what you were saying about Timothy, who is a true historic character, and he was born to a pagan Greek father and a Jewish mother, right? Why I don't call myself a Christian Andrew, even though I've realized in writing this book I am still very much under the sign of Christian ethics, that they are still really important to me, is that I don't believe in the split that the Christian faith does between body and soul, where the flesh is corrupt and the spirit is pure. And that has been so damaging, I think. across the history of the church. And yes, I'm writing under the shadow of what's been happening with the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the consequences of that terrible opposition. So these are... But to get... To be so listeners are clear, these are the ideas going into the novel, but I wanted those ideas to be personified by actual flesh and blood and real people. So the big work of the novel is to make those characters come alive for you, and that you will believe that you are there in the ancient world 2,000 years ago.
I want to come to something you just mentioned there, and I know we don't have a lot of time. I'm looking at the clock, but if we can touch on the penultimate book of Damascus, you show Timothy and Abel. They're both students of Paul. They're in Ephesus some generation after Paul's death. And throughout this book of Damascus, they argue over interpretation of the biblical teachings and the iterations of the factions within their group. Timothy is the head of the group in Ephesus, and Abel is the head of the group in
Colossae.
It felt like a turning point in the book, in the history. You mentioned the way we grapple, say the modern Catholic Church is grappling with its history. It felt like a turning point for this nascent religion, a moment that we might be able to recognize here 2,000 years later, where things became political, where things started going wrong. Can you talk a little bit about this scene and what you wanted to convey?
Yeah, so what happens is that third part happens after the death of Paul. It also happens after the destruction of Judea and Jerusalem by the Romans. And one of the things that animated the early Christians was the belief that Jesus was going to return, and it was right around the corner. If Jesus is going to return in a matter of days or months, or like a thief in the night, as Paul writes, then you can live a celibate life. You can give up all your property, which is one of the commands of Christianity. You can live that way because he is coming. And then I have these old people realizing he is yet to come. And it's much, much harder to sustain those kind of ethics and ways of living into a perpetual future. And that, I think, is one of the struggles of the church. The other thing, though he doesn't have a chapter of his own, I've created Thomas, who is one of the 12 apostles, who there's an apocryphal legend, and it is a legend, that he is Jesus's twin brother, and Judas Thomas Didymos Thomas. So the Didymos is the Greek word for twin, Thomas is the Aramaic. So it's punctuated twice for us, and there is also, I discovered in the reading, a gospel that had been eliminated. There's so many gospels that have been eliminated by the church when it became the official religion of the Roman Empire, including the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, which is the voice written in a gospel written in the voice of a woman.
So these are the Gnostic gospels that were only discovered about 80 years ago.
That's right. And one of the but one of the profound things about the Thomas Gospel is that it is, you know, there's as in scholarship, there's always debate, but it is arguably one of the early Christian written texts, and is contemporary to the Gospel of John, which is one of the canonical ones, Gospels. When you read the Gospel of Thomas, there is no resurrection. Jesus dies. So what we have are his words. And I realized as soon as I read it, and Andrew, you come from a religious background, so yeah, it was like, why had I never been told about this, that there's this other tradition?
I remember a similar moment when I discovered this, and yeah.
And for me, Thomas is kind of the shadow action character. The real wrestling is between Paul and Thomas, because these are the two different ways Christianity could have gone, the Pauline or the Thomas way, which is, and the Thomas way is harder because it's to live in that perpetual doubt, you know, that he will never come. He came once, and that's what we have to be, we have to be satisfied with the words. Yeah. And so that final section really is me trying to come to make it vivid to the reader how then this faith began to splinter under the force of all these historic weights, really, you know, what, and if anything that I'm really wanted to do was, I'm going to use a very Christian metaphor, I wanted to resurrect Thomas, because I think that is actually a very important way we could, that early Christianity could have gone. And it was, I'm sorry that for 1700 years it got lost.
Yeah. One thing that has, I'm going to go so far as to say plagued me as I read this is, I approached this and I thought, do I need this book in my life? I think I know this story. And I started reading it because, partly for the opportunity to speak with you, because you're a very exciting person to speak to, very exciting person to read. And as I read, I realized what you were doing and what you were saying in this book. And I've talked about the reverberations that I felt in our current world. And so with that in mind, I wondered, what is something that maybe you could tell me or tell people who are in a similar situation to me, something from your research, something from your writing that you discovered, someone who might miss this book because they think they already know the story?
I would say that because these ancient words have been so clouded over by power and mystery and mythology, they have lost their potency. But I think that if you actually go back to them and that you really place yourself in the world that they emerge from, you will be, what is the word that you will be? I mean, I think you will be humbled by them. You know, that there is, I mean, I've been wrestling with this stuff for a very, very long time, Andrew. I think it's, I would say that there is, that this isn't, that you can read this book if you're an atheist. Yeah. Because it isn't really about, you know, the value of religion. It's actually a book, and this is, it ties back right to Barracuda, which also had the same concern for me. It's like, do we want to live a good life on this planet? Mm-hmm. And do we want to live it in a life that is kind and generous and welcoming? Yeah. Right? That those are ancient and contemporary concerns, really. And that if you shrug off where some of these ethics came from, you're actually shrugging off a potential to make them part of how we live now. Yeah. I think we need to know our history. I'm a real believer in that. And I think we need to learn our history at every moment of our lives in so many ways. And that's what I would say to someone about the book I've tried to write. But I would say you don't have to find it for a Damascus. Just don't be scared of history. You know, and don't be smug about history. So many of us are really smug, and we try and put history in its place. We would never have done that. In 500 years, people will, if they exist on this planet, will be looking back at what we've done, and they will say, how could they be so terrible?
What you said about being a student, it needs that humility. It needs that to be humble and to learn. Mate, I've had such a great conversation. I wish we could continue.
I do. And Andrew, thanks for being completely, upfront and honest. And this book means so much to me because these ideas mean so much to me.
I am joined by Christos Tsolkas. We are discussing his latest work. It is Damascus, Christos. So many thanks for you coming in and talking about it.
Ditto, my friend. Thank you heaps, Andrew.
That's it for this great conversation with Christos Tsolkas. Christos's new novel is Damascus, and it's out now through Allen & Unwin. Great Conversations is recorded on Gadigal land of the Eora Nation at 2SER's Broadway Studios in Sydney, Australia. The show is produced and presented by Andrew Popel. To keep up with the latest in books, writing and literary culture, follow us on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook. Just look for @FinalDraft2SER. And click subscribe in your podcast app. You'll get a great new conversation every week. My name is Andrew Popel. I'll be back next week with more great conversations. Till then, happy reading.